The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Hi, everybody. Wait, let me get up a minute. One second. Yeah, I listen to Nicole Sandler. Is it time for the Nicole Sandler show? I forgot to turn the computer on. Let me just walk over here and I'll boot up my computer because I don't want... Oh, crap, never mind, it's okay, I got another one. Leave it there, the cat will get it. Got a little tune here, a little song to sing for you. That Nicole, she does something. She's really there and does things.
Nicole Sandler
what?
Show, whatever it is.
Thank you, Boca Brit. A little spoof on the Chris Isaac intro that I use from time to time, just because she could. Anyway, welcome to a Wednesday. I am Nicole Sandler, coming to you live at NicoleSandler.com on the Progressive Voices Network, streaming to the usual places. I don't even know. I think some of the streams are not working today, but we are on YouTube. We are on Facebook, and as for the rest of them, I don't know. I think it's not working. But anyway, we're here. Welcome to it. I just saw somebody in the chat room said, "What's with the donkey?" So, you know, every day I put together a little graphic, sort of a show card for each day's episode. And today is going to be about the Democrats. And the Democrats suffer from, do I have it up here? Did I put it here? No, I didn't. Of course not. I pulled the audio. I pulled a clip from I did put it up here. Why did it not show up? There's a saying, there's a famous line from a movie. I forget what movie it's from. I think it's Cool Hand Luke or something. And it goes, hold on, if I can pull it up fast enough, let's see how, really? Oh, shoot. I'm on last year's, audio. See, I try to multitask and sometimes I screw it up. But this is the clip I was looking for.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
That sums up today's Democratic Party in a nutshell. The Democrats have always had a messaging problem since as long as I've been paying attention. The Republicans, even though their ideas suck, they're better at the bumper sticker slogans. They're better at getting, you know, getting something that catches. Where the Democrats, they go, well, it's a reconciliation plan. It's part of the Build Back Better deal. It's, you know, it's $3.5 trillion over 10 years, but that's whittled down to $1.5 trillion because of Joe Manchin. They don't have a name for it. So even when I'm talking about it, I'm talking about the BIF, meaning the hard infrastructure bill, or the other one, the soft infrastructure Build Back Better plan. Really, the Republicans come up with these great bumper sticker phrases. And even worse than that, I mean, better for them, worse for us, is they do things, they say things, they come up with just stuff that catches on. And that's going to be the topic that I'm going to discuss with our guest today. His name is John Neffinger. He was, for a short while, the communications director for the Democratic Party, but so much more than that. He's the co-author of a book that people still rave about called Compelling People. He's a communications trainer. He teaches a lot of the elected officials we have how to speak effectively. But there's obviously a disconnect. So John Neffinger will join us at the bottom of the hour. I think Jeffrey in the chat room said, "I disagree, Nicole. I think the media favors the right-wing message." Well, that's true. But you'll see when John comes here, we'll give more examples. I don't want to, you know, we've got limited time before he comes on. So that's just what we're going to get into with him. Before we get there, there's a lot of stuff that I need to deal with. And in fact, somebody earlier sent me an email and said, "Will you please talk about Stephen Donziger?" Stephen Donziger is a name that I'm guessing many people listening have not heard, but you should have. And he's going to jail today. He's been on house arrest for, I want to say, close to 100 days, just waiting for the word to come down that he had to report to prison. But his case is under appeal. Let me read. I'm going to read to you it because it's a complicated story. So he was on Democracy Now! This morning with Amy Goodman. And I'm going to read to you her introduction to him because it's the best descriptor of what I've heard about what's been done to this man in a concise, clear manner. She wrote, she said, the environmental human rights lawyer Stephen Donziger is reporting to jail today after a federal appellate court rejected his request for bail pending his appeal. Earlier this month, Steve Donziger was sentenced to 6 months in prison for contempt of court, a misdemeanor. Donziger has already spent over 2 years, oh, so much for 100 days, 2 years under house arrest after being targeted by the oil giant Chevron. The case stems from his role, Donziger's role, in suing Chevron on behalf of 30,000 Amazonian indigenous people for dumping 16 billion gallons of oil into their ancestral land in the Ecuadorian Amazon. 10 years ago, Ecuador's Supreme Court ordered Chevron to pay $18 billion. The landmark ruling was seen as a major victory for the environment and corporate accountability. But Chevron refused to pay or clean up the land. Instead, it launched a legal attack targeting Donziger. In July, a federal judge found him guilty of 6 counts of criminal contempt of court after he refused to turn over his computer and cell phone. In an unusual legal twist, the judge appointed a private law firm with ties to Chevron to prosecute Donziger after federal prosecutors declined to bring charges. Talk about a targeted attack, right? Amnesty International recently called for his immediate release, saying he was being arbitrarily detained. The UN's Working Group on Arbitrary Detention has also called for his release. But today, he goes to jail. So I'm going to share with you just a tiny clip, if I can, there it is, a tiny clip of his appearance on Democracy Now! It's just like a minute long clip, but just so you can hear this man, what's being done to him is, I think, criminal on the part of the American government.
Talk about the significance. I mean, you have so many supporters at this point at high levels. Yet talk about what's at stake.
Yeah, what's
what
at
it
stake?
Is you exposed in Ecuador?
Well, I think the stakes are high, and it goes way beyond me personally. I mean, on a personal level, it hurts. I have a wife and a 15-year-old son, and, you know, we're hurting, okay? But let's just get real here. What's really happening here is Chevron and it's these two judges and really allies of the fossil fuel industry are trying to use me as a weapon to intimidate activists and lawyers who do this work, who do the frontline work of defending the planet. What's at stake, really, I mean, not only my freedom, what's at stake is the ability to advocate for human rights in our society. I mean, the things I was charged with were I was a lawyer litigating various court orders, you know, for years. Ethically, you know, I'm proud of my work. And this judge just went after me. I'm the only lawyer ever in U.S. history to be charged with criminal contempt of court for challenging a civil discovery order on appeal. That's essentially what happened.
Wow. So you see what's going on here. There's a great piece in Esquire about his case. There's another really great piece in The Nation. I'm working on getting the writer from The Nation to come on in the next few days to talk about this because you'll notice the mainstream corporate media has completely ignored this story. Until a few days ago, I never heard of Stephen Donziger, and I'm pretty well read. I mean, I keep abreast of what's going on, and I didn't know who he was. So he's going to jail today. He may already be there. On his Twitter account is S. Donziger, D-O-N-Z-I-G-E-R. He has a photo of him hugging his 15-year-old son goodbye so he can report to prison. It's insane. Absolutely insane. The other bit of insanity, lovely. Things are moving so quickly that I'm watching my Twitter feed, and somebody named Eric Wasson, who reports on Congress for Bloomberg News, just a few minutes ago, tweeted, paid family leave is out of the Biden economic package due to Senate opposition, according to two sources. And then, oh, gee, another one. When was this one? This one was just a couple of hours ago. Billionaires tax proposal out of Biden plan. This, according to Richie Neal, the so-called Democrat who's the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee. But I got to say, as much as Richie Neal was opposed to that provision, this is all Joe Manchin. In fact, let me bring you, this is changing and changing rapidly, but let me give you the latest of what I have. Manchin and Ms. Enema were meeting with White House officials this morning at the White House. The meeting reportedly ended around 12:45 this afternoon after roughly 2 hours, according to reports, fueling more talk that the Democrats were closing in on a deal. That's the line they were pushing, right? Meanwhile, we're learning other details. Maybe not so fast. Joe Biden wanted something done before he leaves, and he's out of here tomorrow, headed for Rome for the G20, and then on to, Where's the climate summit this year is in, I forget, it'll come to me when I'm not thinking about it. But so that's where he's going, to Rome for the G20 and then the climate summit. But we're learning that, you know, we heard all this stuff about the new tax plan to tax billionaires. Well, Manchin said, no, I won't go for that. Really? Let me read to you from Politico. Meanwhile, Manchin has doubts about Senator Ron Wyden's new billionaire tax plan. Quote, Manchin said the tax on billionaires' assets is convoluted and instead pitched a, quote, patriotic 15% tax on wealthy people. So they should pay 15%, but you and I should pay 28, is what he's saying. He said he did not want to target a certain class of people through the tax code. Are you kidding me? And then Politico says the West Virginia senator also threw cold water on health care and paid leave proposals, citing concerns about the national debt. I'm just so over this crap. You know, this happens. We're in this position. We, and I'm saying we as if, you know, I'm part of the Democratic Party machine, and obviously I'm not, but I'm closer to them than I am to the Republicans. So I use the, not the royal we, the Democratic we. So I use the Democratic we because we have an opportunity like we did, 12 years ago? When Barack Obama first came into office and the Democrats had majorities in the House and the Senate and had the White House, the only time in this political climate that anybody can get anything done, right? So they did get the Affordable Care Act done, but it was watered down so much. It was so diluted that all the good stuff that we were promised that people came out and voted in advance for, that voted in huge numbers for, were let down. And to quote the song I'm always talking about, it's all just a little bit of history repeating. Back then, it was, I told you yesterday, Joe Lieberman and Max Baucus, and don't forget about Blanche Lincoln from Arkansas, and a few others, Olympia Snow up in Maine. They were the people holding the rest of the Democrats back from doing consequential, you know, game-changing legislation to help out the masses in this country who have been shat upon by the wealthy who keep getting every advantage possible. Tax breaks, not paying any taxes at all, tax cuts that add trillions of dollars to the deficit that Republicans say they're so concerned about when the Democrats are in office and trying to do something good for the American people, but they don't give a shit about when it's to benefit the uber wealthy. And the thing is, most Democrats are like you and me. They're living paycheck to paycheck or month to month, hoping that the dollars last through the end of the month. And yet they continue to vote against their own best interests. And part of that, I think, is the message. Democrats have a messaging problem. They do. I'll tell you. So Bernie Sanders, obviously, is kind of livid right now. Again, the official line being floated by the White House and by Pelosi and by, you know, leadership is, oh, we're so close to a deal. Like it could come today. Well, going back to Politico, and again, I hate quoting Politico, but there is no other midday release of what's happened throughout the day. This is from a few hours ago already. It said a very irritated Bernie Sanders, when asked if there would be an agreement today, said, quote, I don't know, but I don't think so. Without naming them, he then said that Sinema and Manchin have, quote, sabotaged any agreement on taxes. And here's the quote. I'm not quite clear in terms of the revenue package. Every sensible revenue option seems to be destroyed. Should we raise corporate tax rates, personal income taxes for the very wealthy? Of course we should. But at least one person in the caucus doesn't want to do that. Should we demand that the billionaires have to pay their fair share of taxes? Yes. There's another person who doesn't want to do that. So it seems to me almost every sensible progressive revenue option that the president wants and the American people want and that I want seems to be sabotaged. End quote. That's Bernie. So there will not be a deal today. Biden leaves tomorrow. Not only does he not have any major legislative win to go and, you know, hold up as he goes among the G20 world leaders, but he also has nothing to show on how he's going to meet his climate change mitigation goals, because that's part of this bill. And again, the provisions that Manchin wants to cut. And the American people, thanks to goading from the mainstream corporate media, is blaming the Democrats. And I kind of get it, because the Democrats made all these promises. They're going to do all this great stuff for us. Finally, we can have nice things. And you don't have to be a billionaire to get them, except you can't. Because two, count them, two so-called Democratic senators are stopping it from happening. This does one thing for me. It makes me want to work harder to elect real progressives, because if Manchin and Miss Enema were replaced by real progressives, this wouldn't be an issue. They'd have their 50 votes, they'd get the reconciliation package through, and they'd pass the other one as well. And things would start to get done around here. But I'm telling you, Bernie used the word sabotage. I'll use it too. I think they are agents provocateur. I think they are, they're Republicans in Democrats' clothing. Apparently, Manchin has been playing coy. He's like, well, I don't know where I belong. I don't belong here. I don't belong there. Ugh. You know what? They're just, go home. If you don't want to do the job and you won't work with your colleagues, then get the fuck out of there and clear some room for others who will. I don't know what Kyrsten Sinema thinks she's getting out of this, but it's really, really sickening. It's really sickening. There was a hearing today. I'm going to switch. I'm going to move on because we've got a limited amount of time before our guest gets here, and I want to get through some of this stuff. I didn't get to see any of the hearing today, but Merrick Garland was at the Senate and answering questions and being berated by some senators, including Raphael Ted Cruz. But before we get to Ted Cruz, I want to read to you the memo that Merrick Garland released. It was October 4th, so just a few weeks ago. Memorandum for Director of the FBI, Director of Executive Office for U.S. Attorneys, Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division, United States Attorneys. From the Attorney General, the subject is partnership among federal, state, local, tribal, and territorial law enforcement to address threats against school administrators, board members, teachers, and staff. Now, the Republicans are positioning this as Merrick Garland sicking the FBI on parents who simply want to protect their children. That's not it at all. For instance, all you need do is a simple, and I mean simple, Google search on school board meetings. Just Google school board meetings. That's all you need to look for, and they will come up. I'm going to play you a little bit of footage from one school board meeting in Tennessee. You've probably already seen this, and I'm showing you this one instead of some of the others, just because I think this is one of the more reprehensible, but the others are almost equally as bad. And there were a bunch, too, from Florida. It's horrendous, this behavior. So I want to play for you some of what's going on, and then read to you Merrick Garland's memo, and then let you hear what Rafael Cruz said. So we'll start with this footage from a Tennessee school board meeting and what happened afterwards outside.
Emotions are running high at school board meetings across the USA over masks. Mask mandates are touching raw nerves everywhere.
Actions have consequences. If you vote for this, we will come for you in a non-violent way.
Yeah,
you
right.
do not have the legal authority to issue a mandate. These parents aren't putting a mask on their children, and if you try to force us to do so, I know I personally will sue, and anyone else here who will join me, please show a shame.
Oh, my God.
Asking you to implement a temporary mask mandate, at least until every student has had the opportunity
Good.
To be vaccinated against COVID-19.
She's a medical
And when
professional.
The school board in Williamson County, Tennessee, voted to temporarily require the face coverings, there was a heated reaction.
Will not comply.
The tension continued outside.
We know who you are. You can leave freely, but we will find you, and we know who you are.
Michael Miller is the driver
who
found himself surrounded. He had spoken at the meeting in favor of masks.
All I want to do is go home to my family and my kids. I'm a parent. I'm not a doctor.
The wild scenes even caught President Biden's attention.
I saw a video and reports from a Tennessee of protesters threatening doctors and nurses who were before a school board making the case that to keep kids safe, there should be mandatory masks.
Local school board meetings are usually sedate, even boring, but not these days, and not just over masks. Across the country, they're becoming the frontline battleground in the culture wars.
Okay, so there's what's going on, right? So, and that is happening everywhere. And just so you know, school board members are quitting because of the threats. And who's running in their place? QAnon people. They are taking over our school boards. So if you have the stomach for it, run for the school board, because otherwise they're going to take them over. So Merrick Garland writes this memo. And here's the whole thing. In recent months, there has been a disturbing spike in harassment, intimidation, and threats of violence against school administrators, board members, teachers, and staff who participate in the vital work of running our nation's public schools. While spirited debate about policy matters is protected under our Constitution, that protection does not extend to threats of violence or efforts to intimidate individuals based on their views. Threats against public officials are not only illegal, they run counter to our nation's core values. Those who dedicate their time and energy to ensuring that our children receive a proper education in a safe environment deserve to be able to do their work without fear for their safety. The department takes these incidents seriously and is committed to using its authority and resources to discourage these threats, identify them when they occur, and prosecute them when appropriate. In the coming days, the department will announce a series of measures designed to address the rise in criminal conduct directed toward school personnel. Coordination and partnership with local law enforcement is critical to implementing these measures for the benefit of our nation's nearly 14,000 public school districts. To this end, I am directing the FBI, working with each U.S. attorney, to convene meetings with federal, state, local, tribal, and territorial leaders in each federal judicial district within 30 days of issuance of this memorandum. These meetings will facilitate the discussion of strategies for addressing threats against school administrators, board members, teachers, and staff, and will open dedicated lines of communication for threat reporting, assessment, and response. The department is steadfast in its commitment to protect all people in the United States from violence, threats of violence, and other forms of intimidation and harassment. That's the entire memo. So, what does Rafael Ted Cruz say to Merrick Garland? What his line of questioning in this hearing today? Oh, you're going to love this. All right, here we go. Take it away, oh, Teddy, you innocent man, you. Oh, wait a minute, I'm thinking of somebody else. Here you go.
We're going to listen to him.
Yeah.
Let me ask you something, General Garland. In the letter, which you told the House of Representatives was the basis for this abusive memo targeting parents.
That was an abusive memo targeting parents? Really?
Are cited in that memo.
It does. He
didn't. I have to look back through the memo.
Okay.
He didn't cite
how many. You don't know how many of them were violent.
Many of them.
Again,
he didn't cite anything specifically in the memo.
Do you know?
I don't know.
Oh,
you don't
God.
Know. There's
and he's
a reason you don't know.
What?
Because you didn't care, and nobody in your office cared to find out. I did a quick count just sitting here.
Oh, yeah.
During this hearing, I counted 20 incidents.
Okay.
Cited.
Not 20, in the memo.
15 on their face are nonviolent.
Not in the memo.
They involve things like insults. They involve a Nazi salute.
A Nazi salute.
That's one of the examples. My God, a parent did a Nazi salute at a school board because he thought the policies were oppressive.
You think that's an appropriate response? I'm not saying it's criminal, but I would say it's threatening. A Nazi salute, and Rafael Cruz is defending that, okay?
General Garland, is doing a Nazi salute an elected official, is that protected by the First Amendment?
Yes, it is.
Okay, 15 of the 20, on the face of it, are not violent. They're not threats of violence.
They weren't in
their
the memo.
Parents who were unhappy. Yet, miraculously, when you write a memo, the opening line of your memo, in recent months, there has been a disturbing spike.
There has been.
In harassment, intimidation, and threats of violence.
Yes,
you know what?
There has been.
You didn't
been.
Look at nobody on your...
And fuck you, Ted Cruz. Sorry, I'm not going to play any more of him. I wanted you to get the gist of the idiocy spewing from this moron's mouth. Yes, in recent months. Let me tell you. All right, I'm going to pull up on YouTube. All right, let me pull up YouTube. And here, I'm going to even show you the screen as I do this. I'm going to pull up school board. Sorry, this keyboard repeats letters on me. Meeting threats. Let's see what it comes up with. All right, so here's the screen, so those of you watching can see it. Top stories, threats of violence, school boards curb public comments to calm raucous meetings. Another one, once considered mundane, school board meetings becoming heated, violent. And then here, these are all, I pulled up video. And it's one after another. Perspective. I'm a Florida school board member. This is how protesters come after me. Another one. Race, masks, and vaccines are fueling school board threats. Absolutely. And this is how the memo starts. In recent months, there has been a disturbing spike in harassment, intimidation, and threats of violence against school board members, school administrators, board members, teachers, and staff who participate in the vital work of running our nation's public schools. And Rafael Cruz is arguing about that? Look, I've got my problems with Merrick Garland, but this isn't one of them. There was nothing in this memo that said the FBI is coming after parents. But that's their line. That's in their talking points. You can go to any one of those Republican members of Congress and pull their remarks from the last few days. And I promise you, to the last person, they will all have at some point said, the Attorney General is sicking the FBI on parents, parents who are concerned about their kids in school. That is pure and utter
bullshit.
It is just bullshit. And yet the media treats it as, well, there are two sides to every story. This is not okay. Merrick Garland said, no, a Nazi salute to a elected official is, ridiculously, my word, covered under the First Amendment. Absolutely. But threatening somebody who gets up and speaks at a school board meeting in favor of masks because they want to protect their children, that's not protected. And yet They are gaslighting you. They're trying to say, oh, they're coming after parents. They're not coming after parents. This is disgusting. It's just truly disgusting. I had another one here. I may have closed it out because I had too much stuff. I should play this for you too. Let me play you one more clip, because these senators in this hearing today were so abusive toward Merrick Garland. And you know, I'm no great Merrick Garland fan, but let me share this with you. Okay. This is astounding. This is, what's his name? Kennedy, John Kennedy, of all things, from Louisiana, no relation to, you know, JFK, it's just someone who's using his name, who is, by the way, not the country bumpkin that he presents himself as. This Kennedy is Harvard educated. And I've heard from people who know him that he doesn't talk with that southern drawl. He does that to show that he's just one of the people that he's, you know, representing in Congress. But this is just here. Can I don't know if I can open this. Ugh. All right. So let me share real quickly before I bring our guest on this little bit from the hearing today at which Merrick Garland testified. Listen to this. This is Senator Kennedy speaking to the Attorney General. And it's kind of astounding. It goes like this.
School Board Association sent the letter to the White House, and the White House promptly called you and said, sick the FBI on parents at school.
He didn't sick the FBI on parents.
And that's what I mean. The White House is the prophet here. You're just the vessel. Isn't that correct?
Come on.
Senator, I did not speak with anyone from the White House while I worked on this memorandum. This memorandum reflects my views that we need to protect public officials from violence and threats of violence, while at the same time protecting parents' ability to object to policies.
Brian, I get that. I've heard your testimony.
I heard your testimony.
Were you worried that you would be fired if you didn't issue the memorandum?
And he laughs.
Senator, I'm not.
He's laughing.
I decided on this memorandum on my own. I don't care. I said from the very beginning, I've taken this job to protect the Department of Justice, to make independent determinations with respect to prosecutions and investigations, and I will do that.
And he will do that. And it goes on like that. Look, it's hard to defend Merrick Garland, number one, because I'm pissed, because I think he's dragging his feet on things that he should be all over, you know, like prosecuting most of the people in the Trump administration for what they did, prosecuting the insurrectionists, you know, if, a lot of things. However, in this case, he didn't do anything wrong. I read to you the memo, and the memo clearly does not show him targeting parents. But this is the message that the Republicans are trying to say is happening, because they make shit up. That's what they do. But this all goes back to what I was talking about earlier, that they win the messaging war. They are really, really good when it comes to messaging. And so that's one of the things that I want to talk to our guest about. So let me bring in John Neffinger. John, thank you so much for joining us today. Let me tell you a bit about John. We first met, I hope it's okay to talk about this, that we met, it's got to be almost 10 years ago. No, I can't? I shouldn't. Okay. But at a training, a media training.
Totally. Of course.
Nicole. Okay. So it was a media training before Netroots Nation in Minneapolis. And, because this is what you do. This is one of the many things you do, is you teach public figures and even media figures and people who are not media figures, how to talk, how to get a message across, how to speak in sound bites and stuff.
That's bad. This new book, how not to be wrong. That's kind of how I think about this. How to be less bad at this. Yes.
How to be less bad. Okay. So, you know, Democrats have a messaging problem, don't they?
They have a few, but that's definitely on the list. The messaging problem. Yeah, absolutely. I think, Is that the rant I should go on first?
Sure. Let's start with that, because I think that's part of the problem here. They can't get their shit together because they do have a messaging problem.
Yeah. I you know, there's a fundamental truth here that manifests in all kinds of ways. That is, if there's one thing that I can impress upon anybody who actually cares to try and think about this, that you can't miss. And that is this, that it is not just two sides of the same coin. It's not Tweedledees over here and Tweedledums over here. We are wired differently than the other side. And so all of the false equivalencies and all this other stuff that we see in the sort of journalistic conventions and all of that, it is fundamentally misleading, and you miss stuff if you listen that way. And in my business, the way this manifests itself is that we have Democrats who, yeah, there are some old school people. We can talk about, you know, whether we're thinking of Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema as Democrats or not at this point. But those folks who get into this business broadly to try and make the world a better place because they care about good governance, because they care about policy, those folks approach talking about politics and policy in a very different way than somebody who went into the business of Republican politics. Because despite the, you know, protestations and gnashing of teeth and, oh my God, I didn't know, of all the kind of never Trumper types these days. Mm-hmm. The fact is that for most of those folks, I'll never forget, there was a guy I was sitting next to at a dinner party once, who, you know, by somebody not political at all, had us over and was like, oh, you're in the same business, you guys should talk. Well, this dude who had like 20 years on me at least, was Republican version of me. And had a blast talking about, you know, clients and races and whatever. And at some point he looked at me, he says, you really like what you do, don't you? And I said, yeah. And it's meaningful to me. And I said, how about you? And he said, you know, it's like selling soap.
Wow.
Selling soap. And here's the thing about that. That is amoral and horrible, and it's led us to where we are today. But it also lends a certain clarity of thinking, because when your job is to do the politics, which you got to do in a democracy before you get to do the policy,
yeah,
when your job is to do the politics, it is to get somebody elected. And you look in a very clear-eyed way at what we actually know about how voters make those decisions, the decision to go to the polls in the first place, and then who to pull the lever for, punch cards or whatever. And we actually, you know, it's funny because we claim to be the party of science, right? Mm-hmm. We're the ones, you know, from COVID and everything else, climate, Jesus Christ. but when it comes to actually focusing on how voters make decisions, mm-hmm. there's all kinds of science out there about how that works that they're very tuned into. And we, you know, we like to hear ourselves talk because we're passionate about our issues. And we should be passionate about our issues. There's good reason for that.
Right.
But that's not actually the thing that gets voters to
move. Part of it, here's my conundrum, okay. Is that, you know, on the right, what I was just talking about, the whole school board thing, you can, what I said earlier is you could probably go to the public remarks by any Republican member of Congress in the last few days. And at some point you would hear them saying basically what Ted Cruz said there, which was, the attorney general is sicking the FBI on our parents who simply want to protect their children at school board meetings. They're all saying that because they've gotten the talking points. That's so far from the truth. I read the memo. The memo said nothing of the sort. And I played some examples of what's going on at these school board meetings. But we on the left, we all think for ourselves. So we don't follow. We don't get talking points. I'm sure some people do, but I never did. And when I say something, it's coming from me. We're a bunch of individuals. They are under one, you know, mindset coming down from on high.
100% message discipline. You know, if you don't have any particular emotional investment in, you know, the truth or the policy or the whatever, you just say the things that you're supposed to say because that's how you get ahead in your chosen profession. That's very different from us on this side. That we're just not wired that way. It's a totally different thing. And you know, that also brings us to another issue too, which is that we still, too many people in, I don't know, is it our business? Is it your business? Is our, you know, our community? Too many people think, well, okay, so here's their message over here. And then here's our message over here. and they're going to get compared. And when they compare, then ours needs to come out on top. And so the undecided people will be like, yeah, I want that one. I'm going with those guys. And that process happens a little bit still, but not nearly as much as we think.
Right.
Because if you look at, you know, and Eli Pariser was talking about filter bubbles 15 years ago, right? And just the platforms and the monopoly, not total monopoly, but dominance that they have in terms of their communication channels to reach undecided voters, not just the, you know, not just the super crazies who they have on their team, but a lot of people just, you know, Fox News is just what's on at military bases.
All over the place. And that's a problem, too. Why is Fox, and I can't say those two words together, I can't say Fox and news in one breath, because we know what they are. They're not news. They're propaganda. And now, because of their success, there are more of them. There's Newsmax. There's OAN. And then there's all the internet noise and the, you know, the Breitbarts of the world. And so their message... You know, it used to be one thing when you were just fighting a battle of messages. But now they have these media outlets that call themselves news that are pushing these lies and propaganda. So you've got a wide swath of the nation who that's where they get their information from. And they think they're getting news. So they believe this shit. So it's really hard arguing with someone. It's one thing arguing with someone who lies, but it's another thing arguing with someone who believes the lies that are being pounded into their heads every day.
Absolutely. And, you know, they to their credit, I guess, yay, Roger Ailes, built that audience because they built Fox News and it was going to be the alternative to, I don't know what, to Truth, I guess, to CNN or whatever sort of mainstream journalism was going on. And then it's so interesting that we found out within the last however long ago that AT&T essentially bankrolled and made One America, quote unquote, news network.
Right.
And it's interesting from a business point of view, that makes sense because part of the issue is that Fox, quote unquote, news has had everybody over a barrel. Like if you get cable, some of the subscription fee goes to Fox News. It just does.
Yes, it does.
Because they built enough of the audience that the cable companies didn't feel like they could leave out Fox News. And so Fox News basically, because look at Fox News advertisers. It's like pillows and post-apocalypse seed sets and gold. I mean, they don't make money from their advertising, but they do make money from their subscription fees.
Uh-huh.
And so once they have this captive audience that believes that stuff that's looking for more and more, then AT&T, let's not mince words. AT&T is probably just as evil as any other company that models its corporate logo after the Death Star. But if you look at what they did, it made sense as a business decision because they wanted to have negotiating leverage with Fox. And so they started a whole nother one of these things that and then it needs room in the marketplace. So it says Fox is, you know, never Trumpers and sellouts. And then, you know, then the downward spiral continues. But I'm reminded of David Frum.
Uh-huh.
Who not a paragon of virtue, but he was a Republican speechwriter. Remember that other Republican president who was the worst president ever before we had this?
Yeah, George W. Bush. And then I remember Ronald Reagan, too, and Papa Bush. I mean, all the Republicans in my lifetime have been pretty goddamn awful.
I know. You look back at H.W. Bush, and there was some... It was a less virulent form. It really was. But none of those people, you know, the excesses of the extremists didn't trouble them too much. And, you know, they didn't stop it. Anyway, from the reason I invoke that guy is just that he is, I don't know if he's known this or not, but apparently he did say at one point, we used to think Fox News worked for us, meaning the Republican Party. And then he figured out finally that the Republican Party works for Fox News, which is to say every morning on the second floor on 6th Avenue in the Fox News building, they figure out which kinds of crazy lies that have been circulating on all the 4chans and 8chans and right-wing boards and discords and all of that. They want a road test that day. Or maybe it's the same thing that they've been pounding for months, like CRT or transgender menace or whatever else. And, you know, they'll ride with those for a long time. But they are drumming that into people's heads, and they really do have the power to do that now. So for us, before we can even talk about, hey, you remember that check you got? That was us.
Right.
and you know, weekends and whatever's left of unions and, you know, workplace laws so that you're not totally abused, even though you're mostly abused by your employers. Mm-hmm. And we got to talk about, you know, why we're not the racist ones and why, no, you're not likely to get attacked by whoever they think is going to attack you today and all this. That we got to respond to all that.
Without a doubt. So
I am so sorry.
No, don't apologize. This is what I asked you to come here for. So that's John Neffinger, I didn't give you a proper introduction when you first came on, but I did tell everyone about you earlier in the program. But just to bring it back up again, John, you were the communications director of the Democratic National Committee for a short while.
Very interesting moment.
We don't really have time to get into it, but you have a great story about Donna Brazile, and it just shows you that things aren't always the way we perceive them. Because I looked at Donna Brazile as someone who really, you know, bent over backwards to help Hillary Clinton. And as you describe it, that's really not what happened at all. She was trying to be fair. But we don't know these things, so we surmise what happened. And usually, you know the old saying about when you assume something. But in addition to that, John has taught at Columbia and Georgetown. You've been on the staff of Harvard's Kennedy School and the Council on Foreign Relations. You've been all over this stuff. You're the co-author of a
You have good opposition research.
because I got it from Democracy Partners, where we have some close friends who work there. You're also the
bilateral commission? I'm just kidding. No, CFR, it was a long time ago. Yeah.
Got it. You're the co-author of a very highly regarded book called Compelling People, The Hidden Qualities That Make Us Influential. So
I didn't mean it, but look.
There it is. Look at that. Okay. So, but I wanted to say that before I bring up this next part, because it's something that you mentioned in an email list that we're on together. You said, and this is so important, the bad guys are doing better cultural organizing and opposition right now. The Let's Go Brandon thing is a cultural phenomenon, and the Biden gas pump stickers are pretty good too. Explain what these are for those who don't know. When I hear the Let's Go Brandon thing, and one of the Republican members of Congress wore a mask onto the House floor yesterday that said Let's Go Brandon. Fuck Joe Biden. That's correct. What they're saying.
That is, I mean, not verbatim. Look, here's the thing. It is way easier and more fun to do messaging in opposition. It just is, right?
Because
you can problematize anything, like a perfectly normal AP English class where they teach Toni Morrison in there.
Right.
Oh my God, you're teaching kids that white people are fundamentally bad and you're racist and whatever. Like, they can do that all day long. And so it is easier. But what I am struck, Nicole, by the fact that they're having fun. It reminds me of UP4 and the color revolutions in Eastern Europe. So the two particular examples that you mentioned, in case your viewers are not familiar with them. So there is one, this Let's Go Brandon thing it's funny. It's
legitimate. It is funny. And it caught on, and they're embracing it as they should.
There was a NASCAR driver who wins. His name was Brandon. He won a race. There was a post-race interview. And in the, you know, in the stands in the background
at a NASCAR event. So, you
know, NASCAR event there, where people had probably, you know, had a little to drink and
they're Trumpers, you know, I would say demographically, they lean right.
They are. And I like things to go fast too, but it is just a fact that is more of a Trump crowd. And they were shouting in the background, fuck Joe Biden.
Yep.
Fuck Joe Biden. Like,
fuck Joe Biden. Fuck Joe Biden. Right. So,
this is great. We're really getting into this. I'm sure that clip is going to show up somewhere soon. anyway, whoever was whispering in the interviewer's ear, right, because they're live on air, and it was a major sporting event, I don't know, CBS or whatever, but they're broadcasting this obscene chant about the president of the United States. And so the producer says to the interviewer, talk about it as Let's Go Brandon. And
they're saying, Let's Go Brandon. Let's Go Brandon.
Interviewer says to Brandon, oh, listen, they're saying Let's Go Brandon. They love you so much. And this fooled nobody, but it was kind of funny. And so now when Biden, you know, gets on Air Force One and goes to wherever, his motorcade route is lined with people who have big signs that say, let's go Brandon, which right. is funny.
It is funny. And you know what? If the situations were reversed, we'd be doing the same thing.
Absolutely.
In a minute. Right?
Yeah,
we'd be all over it.
Of course. So that's fun. And look, this, all right, I'll get to the serious point in a minute. So the other one is just the sticker. And this is great. You know, they have a little sticker that's a picture of Joe Biden with his finger in the air. And the text under it says, I did this. And what did he do? They take these little stickers and they stick them on gas pumps with his little finger pointing to the total, right? And gas prices are through the roof. And
he has nothing to do with it. That's the thing. The president has nothing to do with the price of gas.
And as solid a fact as that is also solid fact is that people get don't grumpy care. And he's the guy they know to blame. So yep. there you go. And the bigger, I think there is a bigger point, and I should be crediting the author here, and I don't know who the author is, so sue me. But there was a piece recently in Salon that took me back to my days of, you know, dorm room bull sessions in college. But basically invoking Walter Benjamin, a early 20th century social philosopher, the kind that our friends, the bad guys, love to hate, right? He was openly Marxist and all this stuff. But anyway, he was Jewish and he was in Germany for the rise of fascism. And so he related in a letter his experience of that, and talked about how fascism is all about the aesthetic. That's the appeal. That the appeal is basically having your resentments channeled and reflected back to you by the leader, and that there is an aesthetic that pulls you in that you want to be a part of. And it's a really, you know, we were talking about policy a couple of minutes ago, mm-hmm. and how policy is not really where it's at. If you're selling the soap, of course, it's all about the aesthetic, and that's kind of where they're at. All of this trolling stuff makes MAGA fun. And that was true when, you know, Trump was the outsider, even when he was in the White House, right? And that was something that he kept cultivating. So it's a thing. It is a thing that we don't, you know, and look, we're supposed to be the ones with all the artists and the culture.
I know. So where's the creativity on our side?
I mean, there are definitely some people who are making some money, making memes and pumping them out there, whatever. But it's easier to tell the jokes
right.
when but part of the jokes are the people in power, right?
Let me ask you this, John. Because here's one of my frustrations right now in talking about these two bills that are the infrastructure, and there's the hard infrastructure bill that's the $1.2 trillion over 10 years. That's the so-called bipartisan or BIF, which doesn't mean shit. And then there's the other. It's the Build Back Better bill, but it's actually, it's the reconciliation bill, but it's the $3.5 trillion that's now down to $1.5, but Joe Manchin won't let it get through. And I don't know what to call it. What is wrong with us? Why can't we come up with some catchy name so we can say what it is?
Yeah, do you remember Cats? The naming of Cats is a difficult matter. Well, we totally blew the naming of this bill. I mean, first of all, I think, and this is only becoming a stronger argument in retrospect, unfortunately, as I feared it would, not to be an I told you so guy, but we passed this enormous thing called the American Rescue Plan, I think.
Right.
It was all about COVID, but it put all this money in people's pockets that then they could spend.
Yes.
And at the time, you know, all of Morgan Stanley and all these other banks were projecting 8% annual growth rates and all these jobs coming back. But we didn't call that a jobs bill.
Right.
Save the jobs bill is the one that is going to be bipartisan. That's the BIF. So the Republicans get to take credit for the thing that we're calling the jobs bill. Like, we gave that to them. Meanwhile, the thing that is full of all the little pieces that patch the cracks that people fall into. It's family leave and it's elder care and it's price of prescription drugs and it's this, you know, and the list is just goes on forever about all the, you know, trying to address all the little inhumanities
yep.
of working class life in this country. Yep. That one was, so it really was the American Jobs and Families Plan. I looked it up. That's a thing. American Jobs and Family Plan. So that was five words. Didn't roll off the tongue.
No.
Everybody called it the $3.5 trillion
yes,
bill.
Which,
as if. Then it was reconciliation.
Uh-huh.
Then it was
the Build Back Better bill. But that's right?
And the lovely thing about Build Back Better, speaking of the aesthetics and the trolls, you know, they love that one. Do you know why?
Because it came from some other thing. It's been around. Biden didn't.
So first of all, yes, the reason that it's if you want to sell this in a polarized country, it's not the best, because Build Back Better, while that is potentially good branding, those words are Biden's. We've heard those before. They're associated with those Biden guys, and it's also alliterative, like it's Biden's
right?
Build Back Better, right? So it's easy to associate with Biden. So if you're trying to say, you know, if you're trying to appeal to people who have a negative view of him, that makes it hurt. But also, get this, when you use it with, lowercase b's,
yeah,
instead of capital B's, Build Back Better, guess what those three lowercase b's look like? 666.
Oh, God. Oh, God. Of course. My mind doesn't normally go there, but
mind is more normal, but you know, right. they're memeing it up and like having a blast.
Oh my God. Yeah. Oh yeah. My God. See, the whole thing is
just how we make policy in this country.
We're screwed.
Like, snickering frogs and 666s and Democrats and all of it.
Right. And, you know, and in Washington, D.C., the Democrats led by Hillary Clinton are leading a child pedophile ring and they're murdering babies. And the stuff is just so absurd. Look, when the whole QAnon thing first started, I'm not going to pay attention to that shit because it's so fringe. It's not. And now it's everywhere. Yeah. Now it's infiltrated the last administration. I mean, I'm really scared of where we are. But when I talk about the Democrats have a messaging problem, the fact that they couldn't come up with a reasonable name for these two bills that are must-pass bills, and if they don't get this done, and it's looking like they won't, and it's a self-inflicted wound because it's Manchinima.
I like Manchin personally, but yes, sure.
You like Manchin?
No, I said I like Manchima.
Oh, Manchima. Well, I like, you know, Manchinima. Because cinema deserves an enema. So she's mentioned. And, right, you know, but right. This is where my mind goes because I'm so freaked out. So, you know, what do we do from here? Because I'm looking at an election a year from next week and we're not in a great place right now.
So, all right. So now that everyone's, you know, next to hopeless, listening in on this conversation, well, look, it is. True. It is not a verifiable fact, but it is true that it is an enormous amount of time in political.
That's true. Yep. A year is an eternity. Anything can happen.
It is true that inflation is likely to go down. Inflation is actually up. And actually, there was bad messaging about that. There were some people who saw it coming, discussed it the right way. But if you've had a total economic slowdown and contraction, and then suddenly, you know, and of course, it's all been complicated by the Delta variant, but then you step on the gas again, things are going to come back on evenly. You'll get supply chain stuff. You get like, so it's not unexpected. This is part, and this, you know, this happened after World War II too. Part of the reason that Truman was not thought of as likely to beat Dewey, if you remember that.
Well, before my time, but yes, remember that.
Yeah, that one had a good ending, but coming out of World War II, you had to totally readjust the economy, right? And so there was some inflation and that was all right. So that is likely to get smoothed out. Now, is everybody going to feel great and hunky-dory and happy? I mean, who knows? But I think if something in these bills, we can actually say that was us and you're better off because of it, that does help. It doesn't mean that all the rest of the problems go away. It does not. But it does give us something to run on.
Right.
And if the January 6th commission, it's moving slow. And, you know, your frustrations with Merrick Garland are very much shared. Can I just say that publicly? But I think the 1-6 stuff, Trump is going to make sure he's on the ballot. And that's going to drive the Republicans nuts because they want Joe Biden to be on the ballot.
Right.
And Trump can't abide that.
Right. I hear
that he will very much be on the ballot. It will be an open secret that he is running. And so I think, you know, I hate to say that Donald Trump is our savior. It honestly wouldn't be the first time that the Democrats only succeed in winning a messaging battle when everything goes so far to hell.
Right.
Under because of Republicans that people are like, I don't want that.
Oh, my God. That's just a frightening thought. That's just a frightening thought. I want him to go away. But I also know that most of the Republicans certainly in Congress, in the Senate, want him to go away.
And Glenn Youngkin wants him to go away, and he's coming to Arlington because, you know, the Never Trumpers over at the Lincoln Project, ran an ad, I think, in Palm Beach, and the audience had won, saying, Glenn Youngkin thinks you're a loser. He banned you from Virginia. And within a couple of hours, Trump had announced he was coming to Virginia.
Oh, my God. Well, good. So, I hope he keeps talking.
How to bait this particular bear. It's a thing that is a thing that people know how to do.
Yes. All right. I hope they continue going after him. John Neffinger, I didn't mention your wife, but your wife is one of the best people in the world. John is married to Elise Hoag, who ran NAREL North America forever, and is now just being mom.
She's, really, is it forever?
For a long time. I mean, for during very consequential years, and she did a great job, and she's just terrific. And now, now you're playing parents together, right?
We're parents. Yes, we're actually parenting our children who grew up in the Trump era with political parents, and so they know, they recognize us for sure.
How old are they now?
They're now 6 years old.
Oh my God! Wow, time flies. I mean, when I worked with you at this training thing, you weren't even married yet. You were just this hot single guy.
No, did I know? You are very kind to me. What's left of my gray and pandemic beard, but I'm trying. Yeah, Elise and I were a thing at that point, so not as single.
But you weren't married, or it wasn't. No, I didn't know.
According to the IRS, I was single. Yes.
There you go. John Neffinger, it's great to talk to you. I mean, we just reconnected because you joined this email list that I'm on that's with some really interesting people. It's like, God, I should have John on the show to talk about the fact that Democrats don't know how to communicate. By the way, you'll appreciate this. I think if you want to use it for anything, you're welcome to it because I offered it to Fox and they haven't taken me up on it, but I think it's a perfect positioning statement for them.
Your original source for fake news, Fox News. We make shit up.
We make shit up. So, you know, they've been doing it longer than Donald Trump used the term fake news. They've been it. He misconstrued what it means, but, you know, this is a reality.
Make America Great Again was a Reagan slogan.
Of course. Yeah. He hasn't had an original thought, but I hope it winds up truly being the death of what's left of the Republican Party. Let me ask you one last question because we're already over time. Do you feel confident? I mean, we've got an election we've got an election on Tuesday. We've got a few elections on Tuesday. Yeah. The most important one, I guess, is Virginia, but there are others, New York City mayor, there's other governor races.
Virginia is the one that the Beltway media won't shut up about.
Right. Already. And it's now 50-50, so it could go either way. Does this mean anything, the results of this race? Does it have national implications and implications for 2022?
For the Republicans, it's a road test of a strategy that is pure culture, pure aesthetics. They got a couple of breaks along the way. I think McAuliffe has not been at his best. I haven't seen that man smile in a couple of months.
Ever at his best? It's Terry McAuliffe. Yeah,
but like, you know, if he had anything going for him, it was sort of his macker charm, positivity, his optimism.
Right. And that has
been conspicuously absent for a long time in the trail. So I don't know if there are, you know, larger lessons to be drawn from that, but the Republicans are gonna like, you know, win or lose at this point, they've gotten some traction out of this tag team that they're doing with Fox News on whether it's critical race theory, which we haven't gotten our footing on messaging at all, or the, you know, there's been some of the trans stuff, bathroom bill stuff worked in there as well. So interestingly, the only thing that Youngkin, who is the Republican running for against Terry McAuliffe in Virginia for governor, the only thing that I have heard about his economic program is that he wants to lift the sales tax, which is a very progressive thing to do. And it's been interesting to see how the Republicans will, and it starts with Trump for sure, will do take a couple of steps that will actually benefit the lower middle class constituency that they're courting, economic steps. I'm sure they will find 8 other ways to stab them in the back. But they'll actually do some stuff that they didn't used to do under Reagan trickle down orthodoxy.
Wow.
So that's been interesting too. So
But the people, the thing that gets me the most is that the people who follow them, who are the true believers, they're believing a boat of lies. They just, they're marks for the biggest con man in the last century. And and they brag about it. And all I can think is, you are so fucking stupid. Do you understand how you've been taken advantage of, and he's lying and you're swearing to it?
Yes. Okay. So I'm going to push back a little
bit. Okay. All right.
Look, there is certainly a sense in which you were not wrong. So don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to say that that is not an accurate account of the world. Unfortunately, it is. But if you think for a minute about filter bubbles and the information diet that you're getting, part of what's happening is that politics, and this goes back to this stupid aesthetic thing, part of what's happening is that politics are pulling people in who didn't used to care about politics because that itch was scratched with sports or some cultural thing or some other thing. And now there's this fun MAGA stuff to do. And so, okay, so I'll do that for a little bit. And the information that they are getting is very loopy, right? You know, but they are trapped in that. And, you know, we all have this, if it's on TV or if it's in a book, well, it must be true.
Heard it on the radio. Right.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Like, cause if it was totally ludicrous, I mean, it's Hitler's big lie theory. You know, look that one up. Right. But if somebody's saying it in public, well, then, you know, there must be something there.
Right.
Or someone wouldn't be saying something so absurd. Cause I know I would never tell an absurd lie like that. So I'm assuming this person who's telling me this absurd lie couldn't be doing that either.
Right. It's Donald Trump after all.
I mean, he's very successful. His name is on the side of a plane. Right.
He has buildings.
Yeah. And the other piece that, well, two other pieces, and then I will bid my farewell. But I think this is, look, we're the party that's supposed to do empathy. So I think it is incumbent upon us. Did I use that wrong? Whatever. We need to do this. And so a couple of things to think. One, I think, first of all, that a lot of these people are reacting to the fact that Democrats haven't delivered and the factories have gone to China and you can't have a middle-class standard of living and people don't know who to blame, but it's not working. And what the nice thing about Donald Trump is that he channels that resentment. He gives voice to that resentment against elites broadly and a pox on all their houses. And that's not so totally unreasonable. There is a
But he's the elite. That's the thing. And he wouldn't break bread with any of those people who go to his rallies. He holds them in such contempt.
Oh, never in a million years. But unless he's like, you know, playing, biker or trucker or something like that. But here's what I'll say. He does come by it honestly. He's the guy from Queens. I grew up in New York. He's the butt
of
everything.
I know.
He is. And that's real. And people sense that in him. And he knows how to express that in a way that reflects where people are coming from. But there is a woman by the name of, I'm just giving all of your, loyal friends lots of homework.
Okay.
So first of all was the Salon article, right? You can go read my book if you want, but more importantly, the Salon article, there is a politics chapter in there, which is pretty good too, but Salon article on Walter Benjamin. And then the other piece is there is a woman who's on the New York Times editorial board. I have lots of complaints about the New York Times, but I love this woman's writing. Her name is Farah, like Fawcett, but not Fawcett.
Right.
Her last name is Stockman. Do you know of her?
No, I do not, but I will look for her.
So she did the thing that we're supposed to do. She left whatever perch she normally does, New York Times editorial board stuff from, and went to the middle of the country and hung out for a long time with people in a town where the factory had gone away. And she may have done more than that. I don't want to sell her short. But anyway, she writes very persuasively about how if you live through that, why if you're a woman, if you're black or if you're a white guy, the perspectives are different, and she documents that very well. But basically, like there was a world you grew up in, which is the post-World War II prosperity. Obviously different if you're a person of color, obviously different if you're a woman, where the expectations are, you know, that you're staying home, or if you're working class, that wasn't so great for you either. But there was this, nevertheless, moment where some people who didn't have more than a high school degree, if you're white and male, you could take a middle class living.
Right.
And that world went away.
That's right.
And And that has a lot of implications for our politics. And I don't think we appreciate that. And, you know, I know these people, like Gene Sperling, means very well, cares deeply about governance. And for a long time, like everybody else, you know, in democratic economic policy, thought, well, we got to get the trade adjustment assistance right. And then once we do that, you know, the fact that it's no longer a job and a livelihood and identity, well, but we'll get the trade adjustment assistance right. And then it will be fine, right? Because then we'll grow the pie and maybe we'll retrain people to code computers or something. No. And that's what we were saying for a long time.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I would commend, she just wrote a long piece and then there's a shorter piece called Why They Loved Him. If you've got 10 minutes, get on your computer.
Okay. Find Why They Loved Him, huh?
Yeah. Why They Loved Him. And it, I will tell you, as somebody who's, it's my job to understand these things.
Yeah.
And I go back to that piece and I read it every couple of months because it just reminds me, because that's not the world I live in.
No, nor I. I will read it. I'm also, I ordered your book, so I'm compelling people. I did.
Right. So, we'll start with the politics chapter if you want.
I will do that. The book is called Compelling People. But I, you know, I was reading about it and this just sounds like something I need to read. So, because I tend to piss people off, you know, I can be kind of abrasive sometimes and opinionated.
Oh, I see your point, Nicole. Yes, I get it. No, well, but you know what? But you are talking to your people.
Yes,
right?
I'm talking to my people. Yeah. But, you know, I'm also the kind of person who says something to my congressman and I get arrested and thrown in jail and maced by the jail guard and, you know, stuff like that. So maybe I could use a little bit of that
training. Well, but, you know, somebody needs to be doing that, because if we're all, you know, going quietly to the slaughter, then nobody notices.
There you go. There you go. All right. I'll be the sacrificial loudmouth.
Thank you, Nicole. Anytime.
John Neffinger, so great to see you.
Great to talk to you, Nicole. Yeah, we'll catch up again soon.
I hope so. Thank you so much. And say hi to Lilies for me.
I will do that.
All right. You take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
John Neffinger, what a great guy. And again, I got so much out of his training. And it's always good to learn, you know, what to do in front of the camera. Of course, I take all the advice and I sort of screw it up anyway. All right, that's it for today. Tomorrow, Howie Klein's here. It's Thursday. I will leave you with the news. So thank you for being here. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. It's important stuff that we need to be aware of. Let's go, Brandon. God, it kills me every time I hear it, because it is. They embrace that and they ran with it and they're having fun with it. And, you know, I only hate that we didn't have our equivalent of it. So there you go. All right. See you tomorrow. Bye.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Democratic Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, the two who are standing in the way of Democrats passing a much-needed two-part infrastructure deal, were both back at the White House Tuesday night meeting with President Biden. The pressure to come to a deal is high. Biden is scheduled to leave on Thursday for the G20 summit in Rome, followed by the COP26 climate conference in Glasgow, Scotland. Leadership really wants the bills passed before Biden leaves, or at least a vote on the hard infrastructure bill this week, so that Biden doesn't leave without anything in hand. Plus, key highway funding runs out on Sunday. But progressives say they need more than just a framework for the spending bill to vote on the infrastructure bill. That sets up a potential clash with Speaker Nancy Pelosi and other top Democrats that threatens the entire domestic agenda. There has been some progress. For instance, on taxes, Manchinima is allegedly on board with a 15% corporate minimum tax. It'll be on about 200 companies with at least $1 billion in profits, and it would raise around $400 billion. But then there's also the billionaire's tax on wealth rather than income that's been championed by Elizabeth Warren. This provision was written by Ron Wyden of Oregon, but it's coming up against resistance from Nancy Pelosi, House Ways and Means Chair Richie Neal, and of course, Kyrsten Sinema. This tax, this billionaire tax proposal, would make the 700 wealthiest taxpayers the main revenue source for the spending plan. It would raise more than half of its revenue from the 10 richest people in the country, including Tesla CEO Elon Musk and Amazon founder Jeff Bezos. So that's one sticking point. Another is on Medicaid expansion, where there's a possible solution to Joe Manchin's opposition to expanding coverage for 2 million low-income Americans in red states that refuse to take the Medicaid expansion offered by the Affordable Care Act. But the latest info I've seen is that Bernie Sanders' priority of Medicare benefits expansion is not part of the deal. He says that's still a red line for him. On the subject of climate, the White House has told several congressional allies that the spending bill will include between $500 and $555 billion for climate change programs. A senior Biden official declined to confirm the amount, but did say that the White House sees the ball moving forward. Politico reporting that the bill will not include a proposed system of penalties intended to get power companies to increase renewable energy. Joe Manchin opposes that, but will be replaced with grants, tax credits, and loans to help steel, cement, and aluminum companies decarbonize. President Biden has pledged to cut U.S. greenhouse gas emissions 50 to 52% below 2005 levels this decade. And again, he'd like to have something on climate to bring with him to the Global Climate Summit next week in Scotland. And then there's the issue of timing. Nancy Pelosi wants to move ahead with a vote on the BIF, or the $1.2 trillion so-called bipartisan infrastructure bill. But Pramila Jayapal, who chairs the Congressional Progressive Caucus, says that won't cut it. As they've been saying all along, they want to vote on reconciliation first, or at least have the text of the bill before voting on the other part of the plan. So back to the climate conference, the COP26 climate summit kicks off this weekend in Glasgow. Biden wants some sort of U.S. climate measures in place to back up his pledge to cut greenhouse gas emissions. But as you just heard, it's complicated. In Australia, the Prime Minister finally unveiled a new climate plan on Tuesday, announcing that Australia would aim to reach net zero emissions by 2050. But critics say that could be too little too late. The plan comes after months of pressure from international allies and is arguably the weakest climate plan among the G20 developed nations. In fact, a group of Torres Straits Islanders living off of Australia's north coast just filed a court claim against the Australian government on Tuesday, saying it has failed to protect them from climate change. Here at home, California was hit by a bomb cyclone. Historic rains driven in from the Pacific, a sudden steep drop in pressure that caused rock and mudslides, particularly in the drought-stricken areas scorched by the recent wildfires. One expert said that this week's storm made a 20% down payment on the drought, but it's not nearly enough. However, reservoirs now have water in them, and rivers are flowing, and the storm left snow in the Sierra Nevadas, though not as much as they hoped, thanks to rising temperatures. That helped ease the fire danger. But as the West Coast is drying out, a powerful nor'easter hit the East Coast with torrential rain and gusting winds on Tuesday, causing flooding in some areas from Georgia to Maine. New York City got more than 3 inches of rain with threats of more stormy weather throughout the Northeast. FEMA tweeting Tuesday, quote, "The northeastern coast will continue to experience severe weather. Beware of thunderstorms, hail, wind, and isolated tornadoes." And then there's Facebook. Oh, yeah, the whole world is considering the Facebook effect. As more records are released from the Facebook papers, more news outlets join the consortium reporting on them. Among the claims, Facebook knew its platform was being used to sow violence, extremism, and political discord. Some documents reveal it struggled with its campaign to battle with COVID-19 misinformation. While Facebook publicly touted their efforts, some within the company were questioning whether its systems could adequately handle the task. The whole issue has heightened calls for more regulation of not only Facebook, but all of social media in general. To that end, executives from TikTok, Snap, and YouTube were grilled by senators on Tuesday about the steps their platforms are taking to protect their young users. Facebook executives faced similar questions on the same issue just a few weeks ago. Big news for kids on the COVID front. The Food and Drug Administration's advisory committee on Tuesday made a recommendation to authorize the Pfizer vaccine for children ages 5 to 11, saying the potential benefits outweighed the risks of a rare cardiac side effect. The vote was 17 to 0 with one abstention. The approval came about 10 months after the first adult in the U.S. was vaccinated against COVID-19. Meanwhile, in Brazil, a Senate panel investigating the government's handling of the pandemic voted to put the president, Bolsonaro, on trial for charges ranging from, quote, charlatanism and inciting crime to misuse of public funds and crimes against humanity. That recommendation came down just minutes after the former guy released a statement endorsing him. Trump's statement read, quote, President Bolsonaro and I have become great friends over the past few years. He fights hard for and loves the people of Brazil, just like I do for the people of the U.S. Brazil is lucky to have a man such as Jair Bolsonaro working for them. He is a great president and will never let the people of his great country down. What was he charged with again? Crimes against humanity. There you go. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is fully listener-supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.